Empire prepares to enter a new reign of supremacy. Soon, I will be the most powerful sovereign on the continent. I swear to you, our time of leniency will end. My first act will be to rid our great empire of the demons plaguing us. Then we will move on to the rest of the world until we are free from Bhutas once and for all. His people thunder their feet against the floor in approval, hammering fear into my chest. The Tarachand Empire has the most powerful army on the continent. So long as Tarak is at war with the Bhutas within his borders, his resources are tied up. Exterminate them here, however, and he is free to expand his conquest elsewhere.
Let the tournament begin, the Raja shouts.
Men stationed in the towers strike the gongs, clanging them in unison. Through the lower gates, two courtesans march into the arena, armed with metal shields and helmets. They may choose to duel hand to hand, with staffs or with blades. A tournament official announces the challengers, Ameya and Shanti. Each woman thrusts her weapon to the sky when her name is called. I scarcely recognize them this far above, but their names are familiar. Ameya looks especially small. She is armed with a halati, the double-bladed dagger. Wise selection, I doubt that she is strong enough to swing a heavier blade. Still, I do not anticipate her outlasting her larger opponent. I pray that she proves me wrong. Asha explained the tournament rules this morning. 4 duels will take place each day, starting with 8 contenders battling in pairs. The 4 winners of those duels will then face off in a victor's match. The last woman standing wins the finalist title for the day. This goes on for 3 days, and on the 4th day the 3 finalists will battle me in a championship match. The odds sicken me. Only 3 challengers out of 24 will survive to face me in the arena.
Faster,
Lakia snaps at the servant, fanning her with ostrich feathers. Lakia does not fight until the last day either. She and her challengers will battle as the opening act for my match. More servants fan the courtesans and wives below. Those contenders not slated to fight today sit forward in their seats. Soon it will be their turn. Any of the women in the arena could someday be their adversary. Or mine. The gongs ring, signaling the start of the duel. The taller, stronger fighter, Shanti, dives at her opponent. The little courtesan, Ameya, is nimble and spry. She dodges her opponent's kanda and blocks blows with the halari. Shanti slices the little one's hand, and Ameya retreats. I want to shut my eyes and shield myself from the blood, but even though these women battle each other, they are challenging me. I will not be able to look away in the arena, and I will not now. Shanti circles Ameya. My fingers curl down on the armrests of my throne. Ameya slashes forward, and her smaller blade grazes Shanti's back. Shanti assesses her uncritical injury and then retaliates. Ameya evades Shanti's blade, but Shanti anticipates her lateral move. Shanti swings back around and drives the sword into Ameya's stomach. The slighter woman crumbles like a paper doll torn down the middle, dropping in a bloodied heap. Unshed tears burn my nose. I had anticipated it would be like this, but I am struck by the carnage, the horror, and the nauseating stench of blood rising up from the arena floor. Lakia yawns. I hope all your courtesans aren't defeated so easily.
Yes, it will make for a tedious day,
Tarak replies, sipping his flask. I cut them a glare. Ameya just sacrificed her life. She wanted freedom from being a courtesan so much that death was a better alternative. I want to shred Tarek's pampered face with my nails. But I do as Mathura said. I absorb my hatred and let it feed me, transforming it into something bigger, meaner, uglier. I will wait. I will crouch in the dark until the time is ripe, and then I will eat Raja Tarak alive. Servants wheel a handcart into the arena and pile Ameya's body onto it. Where will they take her? I ask. Where do you think? Lakia considers her painted nails.
The Raja has no use for her now. She's refuse.
Indignation snarls through me. Her body must be prayed over before she's laid to rest.
The gods don't care about dead whores,
Lakia replies, bored.
The gods care about honor and sisterhood, not this spectacle of death.
I lower myself from my chair to my knees and bow my head.
Get up,
Lakia hisses.
Not until I pray. Galinda.
Tarek's voice is deadly low.
Sit.
Hanging my head, I look through the slats in the banister at the lower balcony. Natasha peers up at me, her eyes teary. She must be thinking of her older sister, wondering if anyone prayed over her body. I lower my chin and speak. Gods bless Amea's soul to find the gate that leads to peace and everlasting light. Below us, Natasha repeats the prayer of rest, then Shyla speaks the blessing on Amea's soul next. Then Ishana and Parisa lend their voices. Idle chatter dies to a hum of shushed murmurs. The prayer ripples out to the other Ranis, each bowing her head in respect. Every courtesan and Rani besides Lakia honors the fallen young woman. A surge of pride pushes me to my feet, and I sit back down. Tarek leans toward me and taps my knee, his tone quiet.
Have a care, Kali. You do not wish for me to tire of your boldness. I still find you amusing, but that could quickly change.
I shrink away from him, my insides boiling. Only Tarek would view a prayer as rebellion, but I need not show my support for the defeated challengers again. My message has been felt by his court. Those who perish in this tournament are not refuse. They are our sisters. Gongs ring in unison, followed by a tournament official proclaiming the start of the second duel. Witnessing the bloodbath of the next two duels does not get easier for me. However, Lakia's smile widens with each passing death. One less woman with whom to share her husband. At midday, we pause for a meal. I wave off the food tray, too nauseated to keep anything down. The dirt arena floor, once brown, is splattered with blood. When the time comes, I do not know how I will find the courage to add to the gore. When the midday meal finishes, Anjali is summoned with Kala for the fourth duel. Tarek remains relaxed in his throne, displaying no worry for the youngest of his favorite four. The gongs ring and Kala lunges. Anjali dismembers Kala's arm in the first blow. Kala sinks to her knees with an agonized yell. Anjali silences her with a clean blow to the heart. Tarek claps loudly and Lakia scowls at him. I cringe away from both of them. Seeing Anjali fight, I am certain she could defeat me. Someone with her skill would not need to stoop to sabotage. A different courtesan slipped the asp into my bed, and with four competitors already dead, I may never know who. The four winners are called out for their final match of the day. All, save Anjali, bear injuries from their earlier battle. Selfishly, I wish for their speedy deaths and a swift end to this butchery. A rapt silence blankets the crowd. The gongs boom, reverberating down to the marrow in my bones. The attacks commence. Tired arms swing heavy blades. Pained grunts carry over hushed spectators. The first challenger defeated falls, awakening the spectators' voices. Then a second fighter is downed. There is more frantic applause. Only Anjali and Shanti remain. Tarek sits forward, his gaze fixed on Anjali. His favorite courtesan paces around her opponent, but she is limping and her kanda is lowered. Anjali is losing strength. Shanti swings at her. Anjali dodges and kicks Shanti in the kneecap. Shanti drops to the ground. I wince, and the audience roars. Anjali brandishes her sword, swinging it flagrantly for all to see, and then she stands over her injured opponent and drives the blade between Shanti's eyes. It is a ruthless triumph that petrifies me to the soul. 22. I fend off Tarek's wandering hands and sloppy kisses during the return procession to the Turquoise Palace. He is all hands when he is drunk, but his reaction time is slower. I abandon him at the howdah and run off through the crowded courtyard into the palace ahead of my guards. The corridors fly by in a haze. I burst into my room, ready to scream or sob or both. Devin turns from my balcony, where he was watching the procession arrive, his eyes brimming with compassion. Finding him waiting for me unlocks the fear I have held in all day. Warm tears trickle down my cheeks. He opens his arms and I feel them, crying against his shoulder. I watched those women die and I did nothing. He rubs my back, his caresses as soft as his voice. They chose to fight. My tears flow faster. His being right does not change the mark their deaths have made on my heart. The palace walls thin around me and I can feel the beyond. I am aware of my tender mortality, how close I am to the divide between life and death. Devin holds me until my sorrow runs dry. I wipe my damp cheeks. I thought you had changed posts. I thought you wanted me to. No, I whisper. I don't want you to leave. I told Mathura that I would remind Devin that I am the Viraji, but he knows who I am and he is still here. I lay my cheek against his solid chest and savor him, his sandalwood scent a precious comfort. I'm sorry I wasn't there today, he says. His gentleness unlooses more of my tears. Jaya's sorry too. I spoke to her while you were gone. She's lodging here in the palace. I look up at him, my heart lightening. You saw Jaya? I stayed behind to search for her. I throw my arms around his neck and hold him closer. Thank you. Devin eases us back toward the wall, out of the open.
It isn't safe, Kali.
It will never be safe. After a day of biting my tongue, I revel in the lack of constraint, and my words tumble out. I cannot forget our kiss. Devin draws me behind the silk draperies, secreting us in a cozy cocoon. My hands remain fastened to his shoulders. I cannot forget either, but I don't want it to be like this, with you smelling of him. I don't want to watch over my shoulder, terrified that every moment I'm with you will be my last. I want you to myself, Kali. My fingers seek the soft hairs below the neck of his turban. I want that too. He tilts forward, resting his forehead against mine. I realize that any second he will come to his senses. His morals as a soldier will force him to stop, and he will warn me that we can never touch again. But Devin inhales through his nose, breathing me in, and presses his lips to mine. His lips touch mine urgently, without a care for regulations or threats. He runs his hands through my hair and pours his unspoken words into me. I should stop this. I should be the reasonable-minded one. But there is no reason when it comes to my feelings for Devin. I kiss him back and remove his turban, dropping it, and my fingers weave into his silky hair. His hands travel to my waist, and his kisses deepen. His gripping fingers loosen as they begin gentle strokes. Slowly, so slowly, his lips part from mine. Devin releases an explosive breath.
Jaya's waiting for you in the herb garden. Yatin will show you the way.
I do not know how long we have been hiding behind the curtain, but I want to stay inside this silk chrysalis forever. Why don't you come with me? I trace his jaw up to the curve of his bottom lip. He kisses my fingertips and pulls my hand away. His other hand smooths down my hair. His own hair is ruffled and free, a soft tumble of waves around his flushed face.
The Raja saw me approach you at skill demonstrations. We don't want to give him another reason to look our way.
Devin kisses me again and smiles to lift my worries.
I'll be all right. Go meet your friend.
Kali! Jaya flings her arms around me and locks me in a hug that reminds me of the musty, dark temple corridors and ever-burning incense of home. I'm sorry about my message. Those were Gautam's words. I knew it wasn't you. I lean back to look at her and my heart topples over. She is very thin, even thinner than I am. Thanks to Healer Baca's expert stitching, her cheek healed with minimal scarring, but a bruise darkens her chin. Rage for the general rises so fast and hot that withholding it burns. "We don't have long," says Jaya. We sit on the rim of the raised garden bed. Yatin waits out of sight at the end of the path. Gautam thinks I'm in my chamber. My gaze explores her face for all I have missed since we last parted. "How have you been?" Leaving Samia was difficult. Gautam isn't a gentleman, but I'm learning how not to cross him. She rubs at her bruised chin and sends me a falsely optimistic smile. "What is life like in the palace?" "Nerve-wracking. I feel wretched for complaining when she has suffered so much worse. I couldn't have survived without Devon, my guard. And I have so much to tell you about Tarek." Her eyes widen at my informality. "And his Ranis and courtesans. I want to hear all about them, especially about your guard. But first I have something to tell you." Her eyes are grave with seriousness. "The night we arrived in Vani, the general met with the Raja. I listened at the door while they spoke for an hour about a book they don't want the Bhutas to find." "The Jala. That's what they called it." She frowns at my paling complexion. "The Jala is the reason for the war, isn't it?" "Yes. The Bhutas want it back. Do you know where it is?" "No, but Gautam and the Raja said it is here somewhere." "The Jala truly is hidden in the palace. Perhaps that is what the Bhutas want from me, to locate their book." "Maybe I can follow the general and find it," I say. "You cannot. Gautam met with the kindred. I overheard them say your name, and then they moved out of earshot. They're watching you." No good can come from Lakia and Gautam meeting together. I have to get Jaya away from them, away from here. A bird stirs in the bushes. Jaya peers down the garden path. "I should go." I seize her hands. Sending her back to Gautam feels like a dagger twisting in my side, but she has given me the answer I needed to force my next step. "Everything will be all right, I promise." "How?" Her eyes swim with doubt. "The Bhutas want to bargain with me. In exchange, they will sneak you out of Vani." Jaya shakes her head. "You're always trying to protect me, Kali. This time, let me help you. I've learned a lot by listening at doors. Let me help you find the Jala." "It's too dangerous," I reply just as adamantly. "You mustn't get involved." "I already am." The truth of that slaps me hard, the blame of it entirely in my hands. "I'm sorry. If you hadn't waited for me..." "This is what we wanted. We're together again." She smiles and wraps me in her bony arms. I search my soul for gladness, but I will fear for her safety so long as she is with Gautam. Jaya leans back and tucks a tiny ointment bottle into my hand. "I made this oil from one of my plants. Dab a little on your skin, and anyone who touches you will become ill." "One of her plants. This is poison." "Will I get sick too?" "Your head will ache for a day or so." Her mouth twists up. "But so will his." I squeeze her hand. She must have used this ointment on Gautam. If he were to find out that she poisoned him, he would do worse than bruise her jaw. "Be careful, Jaya." "You too. I was so worried about you." She squeezes my hand harder. "Then I saw you at skill demonstrations. I could not believe..." "You are suited for this place, Kali. You are suited for the life of a Rani." She would not speak so if she knew how difficult it has been. I have more to tell her, but Jaya kisses my cheek and runs off, leaving me alone with a chill entombing my heart. 23. I dine alone in my chamber and then send my supper tray away with Asha for the night. The palace is still crawling with guards on high alert. But the burner will come. He must, or we will run out of time. I sketch to calm my mind, but I find myself mulling over what lie to tell Devon. I do not know how I will hide this from him, but I have to try. He will not understand what I must do.
You draw beautifully.
Devon sits beside me on the bed and looks at my drawing.
Where is this?
A meditation pond in Samia. I shut the sketchbook feeling foolish. I don't know why I thought of it. I will never see it again.
You don't know that.
Devon takes the sketchbook from me and reopens it. He flips through the pages, pausing on a portrait of the fire god, Enlil, that I drew last night after the burner left. Less is known about the fire god. His history is shrouded in smoke. So I drew him obscured in a haze, but I could not get his ember eyes correct. I take back my sketchbook and set it out of Devon's reach. He grips his knees and looks down at his hands.
I have been thinking about us since I last saw you, and I have decided it would be best for us both if I request to be reassigned at the conclusion of the tournament.
His words take a moment to hit me, and then I fall back into the mound of pillows. Earlier you said...
I was impulsive and selfish. I shouldn't have misled you. I'm a soldier. This is what the gods want of me, and you...
He looks up at me with a mix of wonder and regret.
You are fated to be Rami. I won't stand in your way.
But you aren't in my way. You're my only safe place in the world right now.
I cannot be anything to you, Kali.
His fingertips dig into his knees.
I cannot watch you wet him. I cannot escort you to your husband's bedchamber night after night. I cannot protect you from him.
I steal my tone. You chose to stay and guard me.
I shouldn't have. As your guard, I should be able to do all that is required of me, but I cannot separate how I feel for you from my duty. I cannot be what you need.
His voice breaks with the admission.
I will see you through the tournament. Once it is over, please don't ask me to stay.
His plea strikes me breathless. Of course, I won't ask you to stay. I soften my overwrought voice, my insides tumbling apart. I wish you every happiness, Devon. His chest rises and falls in uneven levels.
And I you, he whispers.
The burner steps in from the balcony.
Dearest brother, still sacrificing your own happiness for the betterment of the Empire.
Devon springs to his feet and draws his conda. His jaw goes slack.
Rock?
The burner bows.
I have a meeting with the Viraji.
Devon's attention flings to me.
You spoke to him?
You know him? I rejoin, mirroring his shock. Brock presses a mocking hand over his chest.
I'm wounded, he says to Devon. I thought you would have told her about your dead younger brother.
Half-brother, Devon says sharply.
And if you haven't noticed, you aren't dead.
Brothers? My gaze bounces between them. They have the same slope to their nose, but otherwise they look nothing alike. Brock's coloring tends toward copper, and he is wiry, whereas Devon is robust. But I see pieces of Mathura in both of them. Devon has his mother's large, dark eyes, and Brock has his mother's bright, wide smile. But it is what I cannot see in Brock that astounds me. Devon's brother is a Buddha.
You're a traitor. Devon pushes out of a tight jaw. You pretended to be a soldier, but you worked for the warlord. You knew the Galer planned to attack. That's the only way you could have survived.
Just as well. Brock's eyes burn tawny in the low light.
You left me for dead.
Devon steps back from the blow of this accusation.
You betrayed our troop. You let me think you had been killed. Kali mentioned that the burner she met had golden eyes, but I didn't want to believe you would do this to me. I did no worse than you did to me. You could have tied me to the boulder, but you chose to save the Raja.
Brock approaches Devon's extended blade, undaunted.
All my life, you refused to see what I am.
When I miraculously recovered from my fevers, you never asked me how. But you must see Tarek's corruption, his brutality, his lies. You cannot be that blind.
Devin steps forward and skims the tip of his conda across Brock's breastbone.
I see a coward hiding in the palace and a demon placating a guard. Lower your sword and we will see how good a guard you are.
Stop! I step beside Devin. He does not have the heart to end his brother, but that does not mean that he will not hurt him. I look to Brock.
I accept your bargain.
What bargain?
Devin demands, voice rising.
She hasn't told you?
Brock grins. I wish that I could cover his mouth with both my hands as he says,
Viraji is a Buddha. A burner, to be precise.
Devin's eyes broaden in disbelief. I am unable to utter a defense, not even to tell him about my fevers, which, it seems, Brock also suffered as a child. Devin sputters out a reply.
Kali isn't a...
I assure you, she is exactly as I say.
Brock scoffs at his older brother.
You accuse me of hiding in the palace when you escorted her, a Buddha, here.
You aren't hiding now, Devin retorts.
One shout and you will be stoned by dawn.
Hilarity drops off Brock's face.
Then the Viraji? Will you turn her in, too? Your cold loyalty is undiscerning, but I thought one burner in your life would be worth sacrificing your damnable obligation for. Brock?
I glare a warning. This is not about their broken brotherhood, but his claim that I am a Buddha. You have not proven what I am.
I will as soon as your tonic dosage wears off.
That isn't until sunrise. Dawn is hours away. I doubt that these two could last that long without pummeling each other.
The quicker solution is you raise,
says Brock.
We let your blood.
My cheeks sap of warmth. Devin rises to his entire intimidating height, his hands tightly gripping his sword.
Sounds unappealing, doesn't it?
Brock adds with a humorless smile.
But better I cut you than the Raja. I won't bleed you dry.
I will slice your head off before you touch her,
Devin growls.
Are you certain you don't want to be with her, brother? You're clearly smitten.
Brock sends Devin an infuriating grin, and then turns to me.
Raising, or letting your blood, is the safest way to release your suppressed powers. It will take an hour, two at most. We have to leave now if you're to return by dawn.
No.
Devin levels his sword at his brother.
Kali, he cannot be trusted. And she can trust you,
Brock counters.
You will turn her in.
Devin jolts, affronted.
I will not. Without our help, her powers will destroy her. This is the only way she will live.
Brock's avowal echoes what I have read in Buddha Origins. Without the tonic remedy to lower my fevers, my powers will turn on me faster than any stoning mob. Raising sounds worse than drinking 1,000 vials of tonic, but if it does what Brock claims, I will never need the tonic again.
What do you want from her in return?
Asks Devin. Brock's expression closes off.
The warlord will discuss the bargain with her.
Devin jabs the conda at him.
Not good enough.
I insert myself between them before Devin takes off his brother's head. The warlord may want something from me badly enough to help me overcome my fevers, but I need something from him as well. My agreement stands. I avoid looking at Devin. I will come with you and raise. In exchange, you will help Jaya escape from the palace before the tournament ends.
Done. I swear on Anu you will be safe.
Brock ends his vow with an earnest look at his brother. Devin lowers his sword in defeat. He must be wondering if it is true, if I am his enemy. I touch his tensed arm, searching for understanding. He does not pull away, but his answer is definite.
If you go alone.
Indecision tears at me. He is my safety, my place of peace. I want to crawl into his arms and surround myself in his goodness, but I cannot ask him to betray the Raja any more than I can force him to stay on as my guard. I run my hand down Devon's arm, knowing he will likely never forgive me. Do what you must, I say. But know that I must go. Fighting every inclination to stay near him, I start toward Brock.
Kali, please! Devon's desperate gaze reaches out for me. You cannot trust them!
Brock leans casually against the wall.
I wager I can change your mind about that.
Devon's expression chills.
You're nothing but a dead man pretending to be someone I used to care for. What makes you think anything you say could affect me?
Mother is going to be killed, says Brock. My heart drops like a stone, and Devon's attention intensifies on his brother.
In the story of Enlil's 100th Rani, any surviving courtesans were drowned. Our informant in the palace learned that Tarek plans to kill Mother and the rest of his courtesans according to the tale.
He believes it is fate. I cover my mouth with my hand.
Why? His courtesans are a sign of his power.
Brock's lips angle downward.
Tarek fears the wrath of the gods if he doesn't reenact the tale. That's why you're fighting in the tournament despite his adoration for you. He needs you to play your part.
My mind whirls back to a sickening memory. The day I first arrived at the palace, Tarek spoke of me playing a role.
Your informant is lying, says Devon. You are lying! For what purpose? Mathura is my mother too!
Devon crosses the chamber in four strides and shoves Brock against the wall.
Do not speak of Mother. She mourned you. She still mourns you.
Brock pushes him off.
I lost my family too. You chose to lose us.
Devon circles away, fuming. I watch him from the corner of my eye and ask Brock, when?
The morning after the wedding, the courtesan's wing will be emptied, Brock says.
He appeals to his brother next.
If you still don't believe me, come with us and you can hear it from someone you trust.
Devon glances my way for an explanation, but I do not know who that trusted person could be. I, too, am reluctant, afraid of walking into a trap. I believe that Brock cares for his brother and that he would not lead us into harm's way. However, Brock is loyal to his people. Even with his vow, I fear his intentions are purely in favor of the Butas. Devon's glare cinches in on his brother.
Does the warlord have a plan to save Mother? I wouldn't have told you about this if he didn't.
I plead silently with Devon to join me. Coming along must be his choice. He nods shortly.
Fine. I'll go along.
Brock's grin nearly splits his face.
Meet me in the chapel.
He walks to the balcony, leaps over the banister, and drops out of sight. Devon turns his back to me.
Why didn't you tell me you met Brock?
I didn't know he was your brother.
And if you had known?
I hold my tongue. I doubt that I would have told Devon even then. He sighs wearily and faces me.
Are you armed?
I pat the dagger tucked against my lower back. A useless precaution. My blade will not protect us against Buddha powers. Neither will Devon's sword. Yet he sheaths it in preparation. I let him have the reassurance of his steel. For once we face the warlord, we will be at his mercy. 24. Before we meet Brock, we have to pass Manas and Yatin stationed outside my door. Devon and I come up with a quick justification and go out to meet them. The captain has offered to escort me to the chapel, I say, sniffling like I have been crying. He suggested that I pray for my fallen contenders. Yatin nods with understanding. Manas eyes us more closely, not as easily convinced.
Would you like us to come along?
He asks.
No one will bother the Viraji in the chapel, answers Devon. One guard will be enough. You are both relieved of duty for the night.
Yatin extends a sympathetic smile to me. Manos frowns suspiciously at his captain. Devon challenges the young guard with a direct stare until Manos bows curtly, and we go. Brock waits for us at the back of the chapel. Before I can inquire why we are here, he lifts the bottom corner of a long tapestry on the wall, exposing a hidden passageway. Devon ducks through first without any sign of surprise or trepidation. My hand hovers over the dagger hidden at my back as I step into the dark. Brock leads us down a stone stairwell, his oil lamp lighting our way. My heartbeat echoes with each footfall. "How did you know this was here?" I whisper.
"Devon and I found these passageways as children. There's a network of them all over the palace. We used to slip out of the nursery through them. When we were older, we used the passageways to escape kitchen duties."
Devon stares straight ahead, unmoved by his brother's memories. Brock must have also used these tunnels to sneak around the palace before and after our meetings. The stone steps give way to a steep, gravel decline. My feet crunch over loose rocks as the passage narrows to a low-ceilinged tunnel. Water runs down the muddy walls to rivulets at our feet. I skid on a slick rock, and Devon is immediately at my side.
"Take my hand," he says.
I clasp it hard. I have wished for time alone with him in the dark, but this is not what I envisioned. We descend deeper underground, the damp air laying a heavy film on my skin. Gradually, our surroundings lighten to a hazy gray that peels back the darkness. The running water grows louder, rushing in my ears. Brock blows out the lamp, and Devon releases my hand. My fingers twitch at the loss of his comforting touch. My eyesight adjusts, and I make out the shape of Brock in front of us. The tunnel opens to an enormous underground shaft. Bits of light from the city above filter through slim openings in the high ceiling.
"What is this place?"
My voice bounds off the walls and comes back to me.
"The last of the turquoise mines,"
Devon replies.
"Several passageways lead down here, though they are mostly forgotten. Veins of turquoise run throughout the rock along the banks of the underground river. Many of those veins have since dried up, and the mines have closed."
Our path turns onto a ledge along the riverbank, and up a sheer incline. Something shiny catches my eye. Along the wall, scraggy streaks of robin's egg blue gleam through the dirt, the remains of a turquoise vein. We walk uphill long enough to tax my legs, right up to a wooden door. Anything could be on the other side.
"Viraji, once you step through the door, there is no turning back."
Brock means I cannot go back on our bargain, but I am more concerned about the raising than I am about what the Buddhas have planned. The thought of being bled roils my stomach.
"Kali,"
Devon says quietly,
"are you certain this is what you want?"
Hesitancy paralyzes me. I am frightened of what I can do without my tonic, but I am also afraid of what will happen if I do not raise. My gaze skips from the door to Devon.
"What if Brock is right about me?" "You needn't worry about that, Kali."
"I am worried. I will not let him dismiss this as an extension of his own squashed feelings for his brother. This could reveal me to be a Buddha." He flinches at the word.
"You hate them.
You cannot ignore that."
"Certainly he can,"
Brock retorts. Devon hurls a glower at his younger brother, and then refocuses on me.
"I don't hate Buddhas. War demands allegiance. I had to pick a side, and I chose the Empire. That doesn't mean I stopped caring about the people who matter most to me."
Brock scowls at his feet. Devon pauses, reaching for the right words.
"I know what it's like to run from who you are. I tried that when I joined the Brotherhood. But I was meant to be a soldier."
"Exactly my point," I say. Concern makes my voice scratchy. "If I'm a Buddha, that would make us
enemies,"
Brock says, confronting Devon with an arched brow.
"It isn't too late to turn back. The Viraji can carry on without you."
Whether in defiance of his brother's suggestion or in support of me, Devon answers without faltering.
"No."
He brushes my cheek with the whisper of a touch.
"I am with you."
I wish that his promise were for always, but he is risking everything to be here tonight. I cannot ask for more. I fasten Devon's hand to my cheek, soaking in his strength for as long as I have it, and I say to Brock, I am ready. Brock grumbles something indecipherable and opens the door. We step into a stone stairway lit with torches. The corridor leads upward to a cloth draping the exit. Brock lifts another strategically draped tapestry and waves for me to go first. I pass through the hidden archway into a chapel. Elevated ceilings tower above me. Massive painted murals of the gods color the walls with scenes of the beyond, and a tranquil meditation pool with crystal blue waters gurgles at the front of the room behind the stone altar. The layout mimics the Samia chapel so closely that I question if the tunnel took us under the mountain and up to my home. Brother Sean rises near the altar where he was kneeling. He must be the person Brock said that Devon could trust.
Yeraji, we have been waiting for you.
Brother Sean smiles, his eyes crinkling at the corners.
You're courageous to come here.
I'm terrified, I whisper.
What is courage without fear?
He greets Devon with a friendly handshake.
Brother Devon, this is a surprise.
Devon hastily releases his hand.
I could say the same. How long has the Brotherhood been assisting the Warlord?
Brother Sean deflects the accusation with a gracious smile.
We assist those in need, Utas, beggars, and soldiers alike.
He waves me forward.
Come along. They're waiting.
We follow the elderly brother from the chapel, down steps to a small chamber laid with cool bricks. A man and a young woman rise from chairs, but the strangers do not hold my attention for long. In the center of the room rests a table covered with a pristine ivory sheet. Near the opposite wall, on a shorter wooden table, I spot a set of gleaming surgical knives.
We weren't expecting you, Captain,
says the older man. Sunshine has browned his skin to cracked leather and bleached his hair snowy white around his ears. His jaw has a hard edge, and a formidable intelligence is reflected in his ebony eyes. This is a man I would not wish to meet in other circumstances, or cross in any circumstance. The young woman beside the man considers me with quiet scrutiny. I search my memory for her, but we have not met. Devon's hand grips the hilt of his khanda.
Where the Viraji goes, I go.
The man tips his head back and assesses him for several long seconds.
Then you are welcome.
His invitation to stay does little to relax Devon. He stands, ready to draw his sword at the lamplight so much as falls askance on one of the resting daggers.
Viraji, this is Hastin.
Brother Sean introduces the warlord with a pleasant, diplomatic smile. He shows the young woman the same courtesy.
And his associate, Indira, an aquifer. She has come to assist with the raising. If you would please lie down, we will begin.
No. I lock my knees. First, I must know the terms of our agreement. Hostin's gaze roves over me with explicit interest, equal parts exploratory and calculating. A fractional smile purses his lips, and he picks up the chair Indira vacated and sets it before me. The warlord sits back down in his chair, waiting for me to join him. I drop into the seat in front of him. Sweat dampens my palms. Whatever Hostin asks of me, I must do. All I have left are prayers, that whatever he requests, the gods will give me the strength to accomplish, and that if the task offends them, they will have mercy on my soul.
Our agreement is founded upon a single request. You may state your conditions after you agree to our terms.
Which are?
We require only one thing.
Hostin tips up his chin.
We wish for you to kill the Raja.
I stare openly at his calm face. He wishes for me to do what? I cannot kill Tarek. I hear my answer and think back to the amphitheater today, when I wanted to do just that. But that was a far-off desire. I'm not an assassin. Hire someone who is trained.
We don't need an assassin. We need you.
Austin clasps his hands in front of him.
Tarek is almost never alone. He shares his nights with several women at a time and is under constant heavy guard. The only time he is alone with someone is on his...
wedding night, I whisper. Austin nods once.
As the Raja's final bride, you will be the last person ever alone with him.
I clutch the seat of my chair. Austin is truly asking this of me. Not one of Tarek's warrior wives who has proved herself in the arena. Not a Buddha who can sneak around the palace. Me. Everything makes sense now. When the Buddhas attacked my carriage, Brock let me live so that Austin could use me. They spared my life so that I would take the Raja's. Hard laughter fills my throat. I have not yet won the tournament and secured the throne, but they are so desperate to end this war that they are already asking for my help. Or perhaps I have it wrong. This is not about ending the war. This is about what started it. You're after the Jala. I throw my arms wide. Come and find it! Flatten the palace, burn it, flood it. Do what you must to take back your book.
And risk destroying the Jala?
Austin asks archly.
We've looked for it everywhere. The Raja has hidden it well.
Send someone to force it out of him.
We cannot wait any longer. The Raja plans to invade the Sultanate of Janardhan and hunt down Buddha refugees. Janardhan's army is smaller and weaker. Their people grow tired of harboring our families. They will hand them over to avoid war. Raja Tarek expects us to stand in his way, but he will not anticipate you.
Austin sits forward, demanding my full attention.
You must win the tournament and wed the Raja.
His use of must tugs my chin sideways. I will not win the tournament for Tarek or for Austin. But I still need his help in freeing Jaya. So I tread forward carefully. I suppose you have a plan for how I am to win the tournament?
Your powers will secure you the throne.
Again, he thinks too much of me. They have yet to establish that I am one of them. Let's say I agree to your plan, I say. If I use my powers in the arena, the whole of Tarachand will see. I shake my head, having expected more from the warlord. Tarek will kill me. Nothing will save me, not even the memory of his first wife. Pain passes over Hostin's eyes at the mention of Yasmin, but the raw emotion leaves so promptly that I question if it was there.
Brock can teach you how to employ your powers so no one will know you used them.
Brock nods his commitment to train me, should we arrive at a bargain. At this point, I am inclined to walk out of here and never look back. I want to help Jaya, but Austin is asking me to battle to wed the Raja only to risk my life to kill him. He seems to think that I will do anything to save my friend, but Jaya would never ask this of me. She would tell me to find another way, one that does not depend on the warlord's word. Devon rests his hand on my shoulder. His calm, direct voice smooths out my knotted nerves.
What will happen after Raja Tarek is dead? Prince Ashwin will inherit the throne, and we will insist that he reinstate a Buddha council, virtue guards, as in the olden days. Buddhas will hold their rightful place in power and ensure that this catastrophe never happens again.
Austin's plan appears reasonable, but he is leaving something out. I try to think of what it could be, but I am so overwhelmed by what he is asking of me that I cannot grasp what I am missing.
What about the power hidden in the Jala?
Asks Devon. My heart brims over with gratitude for his dependable composure.
The power to unleash the Voider.
I shiver in the warm room, recalling what Brother Sean said about the Voider. A demon core's spawn. A half-demon with the power to rip apart the world. Austin looks to Brother Sean, who answers,
The Voider will grant a favor to whomever releases him. His dark powers are often used to accomplish dark motives. even to bring back the dead.
He lowers his voice as though he speaks blasphemy.
We fear the Raja wishes to bring back Yasmin.
Sorrow crosses Huston's face again. He knew Yasmin.
No one can bring back the dead,
Devon says.
That power is beyond any mortal, half-demon or otherwise.
The Voider was born of the Void,
replies Brother Shan.
Time and space have no boundaries for him. He can retrieve Yasmin from her next life, but only her soul will come. Without a mortal form, she cannot stay here. Her soul must dwell in a body.
Huston's silent stare digs into my skin. My mouth is stripped of all words. Me? Tarek plans to put Yasmin's soul into my body. Devon's hand grips my shoulder, a reassuring force with an unsaid promise. He will not let Tarek use me. I funnel my concentration into Devon's touch, clinging to his stability. But terror spins me around and around at the prospect of being taken over by another soul, my spirit pushed out of its shell.
How do we stop the summons?
Asks Devon.
The exact order of the ritual is unknown,
Brother Shan says.
We were forbidden to transcribe it elsewhere, so we need the Jala to fully understand what would be done. We do know that the Raja has begun gathering what he needs.
Buta blood,
Huston inserts, his voice a furious rumble.
The Raja collected drops of blood from the hundreds of Butas he executed. He waited 17 years to gather enough, and then he went looking for the last component. A host for Yasmin.
19 years. Tarek has been preparing for this since Yasmin died. I squeeze my voice out of a taut throat. What happens to me if Tarek succeeds?
Your soul will go on to the beyond,
says Brother Shan. Devon's hand clutches my shoulder, as if his stubborn will can hold me in this life. I barely feel him, hatred for Tarek consuming my senses. Tarek stole my freedom when he claimed me, but that was not enough. He is determined to take everything I have, everything I am, until there is nothing left of me. Huston returns to the matter at hand.
Once Tarek starts the ritual, the void will open and there will be no stopping him. Kalinda will have to end him as soon as she sees the Jala.
Devon's charged quiet is like a wind screaming at my back. I do not need to look at him to know his other hand waits on the hilt of his sword, ready to fight our way out of here. But my mind has emptied of my shock enough to allow me to see the path before me more clearly than ever. Tarek has sacrificed many lives to breathe life back into a single soul. I do not care how dear Yasmin was to him. No one is worth the heartache and bloodshed that he has forced upon his people. But can I do it? Can I end Tarek's life? I lift my chin and stare down my nose at the warlord, trying to appear fearless despite my quivering confidence. If I do this, I want my friend Jaya taken safely out of the city before my battle match. He will hide her, care for her, and protect her for the rest of her days. In addition, you will save the remaining courtesans. None of them are to be drowned or harmed in any way. Huston pinches his lips.
That is asking a lot, Viraji.
I ask no more than is necessary for me to commit to your terms, I answer coolly. The courtesans and Jaya will be saved, or we have no bargain. Huston's eyes narrow to the smallest of slits.
You have my word.
Misgivings about the warlord simmer in my belly, but our bargain is fair. Anchoring myself to a tiny thread of courage, I finish. Then I will kill the Raja. 25. Huston and the Aquifier prepare for the ritual, cleaning the daggers and setting them in a neat row. Devon is speaking with Brother Shan near the door. I wait on the sheet-covered table, and Brock keeps me company.
"Sorry we don't have time for you to sweat your powers out in a hut the way I did," Brock says.
He rounds out his apology with a smile.
"That was a long day."
If he means to comfort me, it is not working.
Is this truly necessary? What if you're wrong about me?
First, you know I'm not wrong or you wouldn't be here. Second, if you would stop worrying about what Devin thinks, you would know that's true.
I open my mouth to argue that my reservations go far beyond Devin, but Brock goes on.
Third, all burners must raise when they come into maturity.
You have waited longer than usual, so this may hurt more.
I grimace, and Brock's smile tenses.
I will see you soon, he says.
When you are a true burner.
He steps away and tells his brother.
You should wait outside with me and Brother Sean.
I'll stay, replies Devin.
I didn't ask him to do so, but he will not leave me alone with Haston. Brother Sean and Brock exit the room without him and shut the door.
Viraji, unwrap your sari and lie on your front,
Haston says. I turn away to loosen my sari and lie face down on the table. I try not to think of the meticulous row of daggers, but I can still see the cold, daunting blades shining in the lamplight. I slide an arm up near my head, reaching for Devin. He clasps my shaking hand in his steady one.
I wouldn't get too close to her, warns Haston.
Devin grips my hand harder.
She won't hurt me.
Staring at her linked fingers, I remember the scorch marks on the carriage floor. Maybe you should stand back. Devin lets go, but does not step away. Indira unfastens my blouse, exposing my spine. She wipes water down my back and cleans me with a bar of ginger lavender soap. Austin's spidery shadow creeps across the wall as he speaks from behind me.
Due to the toxins in your blood, this will be painful.
I press my chin to my shoulder, bracing for the incoming pain.
Where did the tonic come from? I say.
The land goddess did not agree with Anu giving godly abilities to mortals, so she created plans to temper Buddha powers and told the secrets of them to the brethren.
Someone from the Brotherhood must have sent the formula to Healer Baka. She suspected that I was a Buddha, yet she spent years treating me as though I were sick. My apprehension stretches tighter, and I am uncertain if I am prepared to find out once and for all what is true.
Once we begin, we cannot stop,
says Haston.
Understood?
Devin and I answer together. Yes. Haston appears in my peripheral vision.
Galinda, shut your eyes.
I inhale a steadying breath and follow his instructions.
How many lights do you see?
Austin's deep voice has a grumbly quality, like he has pebbles in his gullet. Dozens.
These lights are the fire in your soul. Every mortal can see them when they close their eyes. For a burner, these are your powers suppressed.
How many lights should she see? Devin asks.
When she has finished the raising, there should be one perfect light, the essence of her soul fire. Viraji, pick a light as a focal point.
I concentrate on a single star in my vision, and my body heats up, as if a cinder has fallen on a bed of dry leaves. Warmth crackles through my muscles. Devin jumps back from the surge of heat, and I am so startled that I let the tiny glow slip from my focus.
Don't let go of that light,
Haston commands.
Hold it like you would an oil lamp.
I picture myself, as he says, cupping the shining star in my palms. The heat of the light buzzes fast, emanating from my skin. Either the room is on fire or I am burning. I cannot decipher which. The flames are around me, on me, inside me. A sharp pain lances across my back. I scream and the small light pours out of me, fading away with my trickling blood.
Good,
says Haston.
Pick another.
How many times must I do this? I pant.
Until all but one light is gone, We must rid you of the extra fire. As it is released, the toxins will seep out as well.
I am less inclined to select another star in my vision.